Good morning.
Morning.
Hi. So this morning I'm going to talk about a little bit about Bodhidharma and Dogen, the two sort of the two guys historically who are the most responsible for our being here today and for our doing what we're doing. And I'm going to talk about three of Bodhidharma's teachings briefly, and then I'm going to look at Dogen's point of view in regard to those teachings. So, starting with, and these are probably Bodhidharma's three best known teachings, which I have all talked about. I have talked about maybe not all, but most of them before. So the first one is Bodhidharma. Geez, I got a hearing aid feedback here, so it's ringing in my ear. I think I'm going to have to take this out. Excuse me. So Bodhidharma and Emperor Wu. Bodhidharma, the story, which is apocryphal, but nevertheless passed down from generation to generation, is Bodhidharma was sitting in his cave. You remember Bodhidharma, those of you who don't know Zen, supposedly started Zen in the 5th century, and he sat in his cave for 9 years, right? So he was sitting in his cave, and the Emperor Wu came to see him because the Emperor Wu was an ardent Buddhist and was trying to promulgate Buddhist meditation throughout China and had set up lots of meditation centers. So he came to see Emperor Wu, and the dialogue went like this. First of all, the Emperor Wu tells Bodhidharma about everything he's done, the way of meditating himself and trying to develop meditation centers, meditation temples. And he asks Bodhidharma what? He asks Bodhidharma, what is the merit of what I've done? And if you know about Buddhism, you know all about merit. But if you don't know about Buddhism, you can just guess. Guess. And Bodhidharma says, no merit. No merit. And Bodhidharma is always a very rough-looking character. So he says, no merit. And then the emperor says, well, then, what is the first principle of your holy teaching? And Bodhidharma says, a vast emptiness or a vast spaciousness, two different translations, with nothing holy about it. That's a conversation starter, isn't it? And then so the emperor has come all this way, so he's not giving up, you know. And so he says, well, then who are you? And what does Bodhidharma answer? I don't know. I don't know. End of conversation. Period. So here we go. Here's the first vignette. And that first vignette, so first of all, no merit. Bodhidharma sees that the emperor is trying to get strokes for what he's done. Trying to get... here he's the meditation expert. He wants the meditation expert to tell him that all this time he's put into doing this is worth something, that he's accomplished something, and that he's gained merit in the Buddhist sense, too, which is quite a trip. And Bodhidharma detects that, and so he cuts him off. Because for Bodhidharma, it's meditation is not about anything other than meditation. If we do it to try to win friends and influence people, even ourselves, we're diluting its power. We're cutting ourselves off from just doing it. We're always anticipating. We're always, what will, finally when the abbot comes, what will he say when he sees me sitting? Finally when the great Shakuhachi master comes, what will he see when he, what will he hear when he hears me playing? And how will I be, you know, we're doing that. So he cuts him off. And then he cuts him off again when he said, well, then what's the, you know, if what I did isn't the right thing, what's the first principle of the holy teaching? No first principle, a vast emptiness, a vast spaciousness with nothing holy about it. So not cling to some first principle. We want the first principle. Whether we're Buddhists or atheists or agnostics or Tea Party people or socialists, we want the first principle. We want to have something that we can go toward. And we forget, we ignore this vast spaciousness, this vast openness, this vast emptiness that really is what everything is. Everything is not itself. Everything is always in this wonderful dynamics, interpenetrating flux. So, a vast emptiness with nothing holy about it. Then who are you? Well, classic Zen answer, right? I don't know. I don't know. But you know, when he says, I don't know, he's not like Descartes when Descartes says, I don't know. You know what Descartes looks like when he says, I don't know? He's, I don't know. I don't know. He's like, I don't know. I don't know. Yippee. Yippee. Because he's not caught by image of himself, by trying to be someone. He's just, I don't know. Here it is, this vast spaciousness with nothing holy about it. So Dogen's attitude toward this one, switching to Dogen, is good. Dogen doesn't get into messing with Bodhidharma on this one, although he does on the next two. On this one, he doesn't mess with Bodhidharma. He said, no merit is one of Dogen's big things. You know, when you sit in meditation is not an instrument to get to something. Meditation is just meditation. He's really down on meditation as an instrument because he thinks that, again, we split our natural energy, which really is present, which really calls us to be present. So Dogen's good on that one. The next one, a vast spaciousness with nothing holy about it. Well, Dogen's good on that one too, except Dogen takes the word holy and then uses whole. Now, I don't know about Sino-Japanese etymology, so I can't say that he's messing with it, playing with the same word. It's probably a different word. But Dogen uses the word whole a lot. He says, not holy, but whole. Whole being Buddha nature. Whole being Buddha nature is your presence, is your availability to life, is your availability to yourself. Whole being Buddha nature. So he would like what Bodhidharma said, but then he would take it one step farther. And then I don't know. Oh, Dogen will really be into that. I don't know. Because, as you know, when Dogen came back from, or as many of you know, those of you who've been practicing here for a while, when Dogen came back from his very arduous journey to China, his great enlightenment experience and all of the stuff he learned, he was greeted by his followers. And his followers said, what had he brought back? What had he brought back in the way of knowledge, in the way of teaching, in the way of deep spiritual sharing? And what did Dogen answer, those of you who heard me say this three or four times? What did Dogen answer? Come on.
Nothing.
Huh? You know, he didn't exactly say nothing. What? Does anybody remember?
All I know is all I know.
Yeah. Go ahead, say it, Martin. Busho. Huh?
My eyes are horizontal, my nose is vertical.
Yeah, that's what he said. All I know is that my eyes are horizontal and my nose is vertical. Of course, if you don't have a vertical nose, you probably won't get that. So, that's the first vignette. The second vignette is not a vignette, but it's the prose poem that Bodhidharma is the best known for, and I'm just going to do the first three ones. A special transmission outside the sutras, outside the Buddhist texts. Special transmission outside the sutras, no dependence on words and letters, directly pointing to the heart mind. So, Zen really emphasizes this transmission. It's sort of really part of what we've done culturally in Zen for hundreds and hundreds of years. And Bodhidharma is pointing out here that it doesn't come from books. Doesn't come from books. And it really, we don't even know where it comes from. It's just something that sort of happens. It's an osmotic process, I guess. Osmosis, you know. Maybe it's, I don't know what it is. But something happens if you immerse yourself in this practice and you hang out with people who've immersed themselves for years, you change, and it feels like you got it from your teacher. I still think I got it from Suzuki Roshi, but what was there for me to get from him? But I got it from him, and it's wonderful. And wow, how privileged I am, and how glad I am. But what did I get from him? He didn't give me anything. So I don't know what it is, but I don't need to know what it is. I don't need to know what it is. It's not a thing, but, and I don't have it. It had nothing to do with Tim. Tim, if Tim carries it around, that's not transmission. So what is it? It's a special transmission outside all of our thoughts, all of our words, all of our concepts about getting something or becoming someone or comparing ourselves to someone. And so no dependence on words and letters, because words and letters get us mixed up. We get mixed up with all of our thinking, with all of our picking and choosing and trying to figure out how to practice and how to do zazen so our mind isn't just like a whirlwind all the time, how to find some quietness right in the middle of the whirlwind, when sometimes our mind is a whirlwind all the time. We sit down for 40 minutes, we've got 39 and a half minutes of whirlwind. How can we just be there with it in stillness and acceptance? It's hard. So special transmission outside the scriptures, no dependence on words and letters. Well, Dogen trashes this one. As those of you know who studied this with me before, he trashes this one. He doesn't criticize Bodhidharma. He just says Bodhidharma had an entirely different meaning. Oh yeah, right. Right. But he's always playing with the teachers. He's always sort of either trashing them or trashing what they're saying and presenting it in a new way. Which is cool. That's wonderful, isn't it? Wonderful not to have this sort of stultified, rigid sort of stuff that's passed down. That's not an alive religion. That's dead religion. So anyway, Dogen says, when you devote yourself to the study of the sutras, the scriptures, the texts, they truly come forth. They truly come forth. He says, language and symbols are dynamic. They're alive, and they're in the core of life. They're in the core of life. They're embedded in the matrix of who we are, of human experience, of human being. And language and activity for Dogen are inseparable. They're not separated. This idea that sort of quiet and zazen and wordlessness is separate from language, well, that's another idea, right? We are linguistic beings. We are thinking, talking beings. That's what our nature is. So the symbol for Dogen, then, he plays with symbols a lot, but it's not an instrument either. It's not an instrument. It's not the finger pointing to the moon. The moon is real reality. The finger is just the word. It's not that. The symbol is an expression of the symbolized rather than pointing to the symbolized. It is the symbolized rather than pointing to it. So we have the simile in Buddhism. The simile of emptiness, being like the clear sky, like the clear sky mind. So there's a simile there. It's like the clear sky. So the simile of clear sky is a pointing to something that we can get a taste of in our meditation. But that's not the way Dogen's looking at it. the way Dogen looks at it. Like is an expression of emptiness itself, of stillness itself. The is expression of stillness itself. Clear is an expression of emptiness itself. Mind is an expression of emptiness itself. So there's no gap. There's no gap. And it's not to say that it's all one. He's not saying that. He's saying no gap. So each symbol is a full illumination of the symbolized. The. Just the. You don't need the clear mind. Just the is the full illumination of emptiness, of spaciousness. Get it? So making language, Dogen didn't say this, but I'm saying it. Like making language is making love. It's making love. And then our the blooms and flowers, and it connects to the other person. It connects to the grass. It connects to the floor. It connects, because it's making love. So then Dogen continues talking about the sutras and the scriptures, and he says, the sutras in question are the entire universe, mountains and rivers and the great earth. Plants and trees, they are the self and others, eating meals and wearing clothes, confusion and dignity. Following each of them and studying it, you will see an infinite number of unheard of sutras appear before you. So all space and time constitutes the sutras. The teaching of life, the teaching of being, which is not a teaching at all, it's just the being. But it is a teaching. It is a teaching. So the focus in Dogen is not on what humans express, but what the way expresses. And expression is both with words and without words. No gap. Both. Okay, so that's Dogen and special transmission. But both Bodhidharma and Dogen put big emphasis on transmission. They both put big emphasis on transmission. Okay, now the third one, which is Dogen and Wei Ko again. So Wei Ko is the... I haven't done that yet. Excuse me. Wei Ko is... becomes the guy that Bodhidharma gives transmission to. And if you look at your... Those of you who do the lineage chart, you see Bodhidharma and then Wei Ko right after him in that chart. So Wei Ko... And you know the stories about Wei Ko, but I won't get into them, about how Wei Ko first approaches Bodhidharma and, you know, some severing of body parts and stuff like that. We don't need to get into that. after Bodhidharma's been in China for 20 years, it's time for him to go back to India. He's ready to go back to India. So He calls his four best disciples, his four most involved disciples together, and he does this little dialogue with them, which many of you are familiar with. Let's see, I wonder where it is. It's in this book. Well, he sat in the cave for 9 years. I thought maybe he did something more than sitting in the cave while he was in China, but evidently not. 9 years had passed, and Bodhidharma now wished to return westward to India. He called his disciples, and he said, "The time has now come. Why doesn't each of you say what you have attained?" So then the disciple Daofu replied, "As I see it, the truth neither adheres to words or letters, nor is it apart from them. It functions as the way." And the master said, "What? You've attained my skin." A nun, Sungshi, so one of his first disciples was a nun, said, "As I understand it, the truth is like the auspicious glimpse of the Buddha land of Aksobhya, which is like the pure land in Buddhism. It is seen once, but not a second time." The master said, "You've attained my flesh." Tao Yu said, "The four great elements are originally empty. The five skandhas have no existence. As I believe, no dharma can be grasped." The master said, "You've attained my bones." Finally, there was Hui Ko. He bowed respectfully and stood silent. The master said, "You've attained my marrow." So that's the famous story. And that's really about how we really have to get this practice into us. We really have to get it into our bodies, into our being. That it's not about who can say the prettiest thing or who can say the most philosophically true thing. It's about getting it in us. And then Hui Ko, in his quietness, in his stillness, and in his simple little bow, showed Bodhidharma, because Bodhidharma already knew, because he'd hung out with these guys, that he had imbibed this teaching. So Bodhidharma said, you're the guy. So what does Dogen say about this? Huh? Yes, you're right. So Dogen, on page 97 of some book or other, let's see which book, this book, these are my notes. Dogen says, "You should understand that the ancestors' words, skin, flesh, bones, and marrow, are not concerned about shallowness and deepness in the disciples' understanding. Even though there are superior and inferior views, the ancestor's words signify solely the attainment of his whole being. Their cardinal meaning is that the attainment of marrow, the attainment of bones, and so on, are all to guide people. There is no sufficiency or insufficiency in holding grass or dropping grass as the means to guide people according to their abilities and needs. For example, it is just like the Buddha's holding up a flower, or like a teacher's imparting a robe to a disciple. What Bodhidharma said for the four disciples is that each was equal from the beginning. Although the ancestors' words are the same, the four views are not necessarily identical. The four views differ in their respective incompleteness, and yet the ancestors' words are nothing but the ancestors' words. Generally speaking, the teacher's words and the disciple's understanding do not necessarily agree with each other." So, there's Dogen. And, let's see. So, what Dogen is saying there is that each in his own way, each of these was a sincere student who'd been around, hung around Bodhidharma for a while, and each in his own way had grasped whole being Buddha nature. That there's not some best way to grasp whole being Buddha nature. There's not some right way. That they had, even though some of them were more articulate, even though some of them were less articulate, even though Hui Ko mastered them all by just being still, it's the same. Because if we wholeheartedly engage in our practice, in our lives, in our sitting, in our moments, we manifest Buddha nature, just as it is. Just as it is. So then Dogen also says, "If there appear hundreds of thousands of disciples after the second ancestor, there will correspondingly be hundreds of thousands of interpretations. There is no limit to them. The number of disciples happened to be four, so there were just four views of skin, flesh, bones, and marrow for the time being. However, many an expression is left as yet unexpressed and remains to be expressed. So we're all the successor to Bodhidharma. We're all the successor. And we demonstrate that any time we authentically express ourselves. We express ourselves from our hearts. Anytime. Whether we've been practicing a long time or not a long time, whether we've had an enlightenment experience or not have an enlightenment experience, we do that. We do that. So then Dogen won't let this alone. He comes back to it. And partly he keeps coming back to it because he's arguing against 1,000 years of tradition here. And even in Buddhism, arguing against tradition is a little tricky. We say, oh, we're so loose and so open. But it's the same thing in Buddhism. We get attached to our ways of doing things, our ways of being. And so these really creative teachers have to come along and sort of just deconstruct and then reconstruct. The thing about Dogen is that he's always reconstructing in his deconstruction. He's always creating something wonderful and beautiful, which then needs to be deconstructed by one of you guys or me, so we can be authentically ourselves, so we can have authentic life ourselves, in closeness to the world, in engagement with the world, in engagement with our moments. So vines are a metaphor that's used in Buddhism, been used when Dogen's writing this. He's writing this in 1200s. They've been used for more than 1,000 years as what? Something, entwined vines. What are they used for? They're used to deal with how we get caught in our thinking. We entwine vines within vines so that we're just never really available. We're always worried about something. And then another vine comes along that tells us to take it easy, and we get entwined in that vine that's trying to take it easy, while the other one is saying, no, you have to do this. And then there's, you should have done this, but if only I'd done this, and maybe I can do this. So you get entwined vines. You get the image? Yeah, entwined vines. So for more than 1,000 years in Buddhism, stay away from these entwined. Actually, what Zazen is about, what meditation is about, is cutting through the entwined vines. They're not the roots, they're just vines. You can just cut through them in your clear meditation, in your clear focused meditation. You just cut through them. So then there's Dogen. By and large, many sages are commonly concerned with the study of cutting off the root of entwined vines, but do not realize that cutting consists in cutting entwined vines with entwined vines. Nor do they understand entwining entwined vines with entwined vines. Got it? Let alone inheriting Dharma in and through entwined vines. They rarely know that the inheritance of Dharma resides precisely in entwined vines. There is still no one who hears about it, no one who understands it. Can there be anyone who realizes it? He's saying this to his students. Is there anyone who realizes the Dharma being passed on as entwined vines? So each entwined vine grows in its own inner necessity without nullifying the others, for Dogen. And he goes on. You should further investigate thoroughly that because of the power to transcend itself, a vine grows seeds into branches, leaves, flowers, and fruits that are intertwined in harmony with one another without losing their respective particularities. So now he is turning entwined vines into a Hua Yin metaphor for those of you who've done Hua Yin with me. He's something really beautiful. For this reason, the Buddhas and ancestors are realized, and the koan is realized in life. So, conflicts, dilemmas, contradictions are human and real. That's all. They're human and real. And the heritage and the vitality of life and of the way, of the Tao, is the entwined vines themselves. Each expression gives us perfect freedom. Of course, what's not being said here, and is it just a given in Dogen Zen, is that the underpinning of this is self-emptying zazen. But not self-emptying zazen as a means to get somewhere. And Dogen talks a lot about intimacy. And he specifically talks in this section about intimate words. And he says, I'm paraphrasing. Those are words that are spoken with no gap between the word and what it refers to. So I've been the guiding teacher here for 8 or 9 years now. And we have practice periods twice a year, and we have study groups in the morning. And we just are finishing a practice group, and people will be a practice period. They're 56 days long, 8 times 7, actually. 56 days long. We do them twice a year. And then on the last day, people do their evaluations of them, and they turn them in to me and who's ever helping me, and I look at them. Well, these practice periods include a Wednesday night class. And in the Wednesday night class, we always have small groups. And small groups just discuss if we're doing Dogen or whatever we're doing. They discuss it. And then the large group comes back and discusses. And I don't go visit the small groups because I don't want to pollute their process. But the person who's assisting me often does. Well, when I get my feedback forms back, invariably there are... We'll see this time. There are 1 to 4 people who are really down on the small groups. 1 to 4. It could be 1 to 6 or 1 to 8. They say, this isn't the Dharma. This is just people just talking. You know, just trying to express, and they're inarticulate, and they don't agree with each other, and it gives me a headache. Well, Dogen would love it, you guys. He'd say, this is the actual, if you really go into it, if you're not using words to manipulate, if you're using words to show off, that ain't it. That's not coming from your heart. That's not coming from your practice. But if you're using words to try to go deeply into something, into your own life, whether you're articulate or inarticulate, is totally irrelevant. You put the word out there with your whole heart. You put it out there. And whether it's bad or good or not, you just do it. And that's human interchange. That's human contact. That's who we are as human beings, to do that kind of thing. And why should Zen be sort of reified above that? My goodness. Conflicts, dilemmas, contradictions. The heritage and the vitality of the Tao. So, another quote. The monastics of future generations will be able, this is Dogen again, will be able to understand a non-discriminative Zen based on words and letters. If they devote efforts to spiritual practice by seeing the universe through words and letters, and words and letters through the universe. So, for Dogen, language is the breath, the blood, the soul of what it is to be humans. And through Zazen practice, we can discover that. Although, again, Dogen would say, you don't discover it. Do Zazen practice first, and then you discover it. He would say, one breath is the discovery of that, if you give yourself to one breath. Not before and after. But sometimes he seems a little bit rigid about that to me. So, and I'm sure sometimes I seem a little rigid to him. So, infinite semantic possibility. infinite semantic possibility of ordinary words, regular words, to act out and to appreciate or enjoy the extraordinary, the I don't know, the I can never know. How can I ever know? I'm just a fabrication, but I can express. I can express. I can commune. I can communicate. Even if I can't commune, if I fully communicate, that's already communing. And each word is just fully alive in the emptiness of its self-nature. So then Dogen goes on, and this is a whole other talk or a series of talks, which we studied in some other time, about dreams, right? He says, dreams, illusions, and imagination fall within infinite semantic possibility. He doesn't say that again, I'm paraphrasing. He says they're as real and legitimate as anything else. And so, from that point of view, my dream of enlightenment, your dream of enlightenment. I hope you haven't given up on your dream of enlightenment. Or I hope you think it's only someone else's dream. Your dream of enlightenment is very important. You need to keep that dream warm. And if it's not warm, you need to hang out with people who will help you keep it warm. That's what Sangha is. Your dream of enlightenment. And your dream of enlightenment, you know, for Dogen, is not some far away mystical state. That's not it. Not it at all. So your dream of enlightenment is completely joined to the enlightenment which manifests itself as each of your dreams. Each of your dreams is a full manifestation of your original enlightenment. Your dream of enlightenment is the enlightenment present within each of your dreams. It doesn't matter. Just authentically. Be with it. Be with it. So then, who is right, Bodhidharma or Dogen? Oh, one of them is partly right, and the other is partly right. Well, we don't really have to get into that, do we? The way I did it today, it sounds like Dogen's right and Bodhidharma's wrong. But next time I'll talk about Dogen first and Bodhidharma afterwards. And then you'll see that Dogen was totally wrong and Bodhidharma's right. So our mind is pretty malleable, pretty huge when we tap into our original spaciousness. It can include lots and lots of stuff. Lots and lots of stuff. So I'll close with a Walt Whitman phrase, which many of you know. Do I contradict myself? Very well then, I contradict myself. I am large. I contain multitudes. And that largeness doesn't come by trying to be large. It just comes by the full expression of what's in your heart. Whether it's sweeping the kitchen or talking to your friend about their confusion about the Dharma or sitting waiting for Tim to quit talking. It's the same thing. Same thing. Okay, so questions, comments?
None, we all get it.
What? What'd you say?
I said none, we all get it.
You all, uh-oh. You better come upstairs with me. We'll see about this getting and this eating. Although, from Dogen's point of view, we, the whole, in the we, there's everything. In the all, there's everything. In the get it, there's just the availability of all life. So, but right now, with you, I'm taking the Bodhidharma point of view. Let's get upstairs and see what this getting is all about. Kathleen.
Thank you so much for your talk. I really appreciate it.
Sure.
What came to my mind is recently seeing two films, one The King's Speech, the other one A Walk with Destiny. And you know, if those of you who have seen the King's speech, it was about the King of England who had a speech impediment, and he worked with a speech therapist who was able to get him to speak to the nation.
Mm.
Critical.
Yeah, yeah.
Those words that he expressed rallied the people.
Yes.
To stand up.
Yes.
So the power of words.
Yes.
And then the other film about that same time period was Churchill and his ability to speak to the soul of the nation to, again, help them stand up in the face of attack. And I particularly like these two simple phrases that were, I guess, phrase slogans during the Blitz of London. Keep calm, carry on.
Mm-hmm.
They just had that.
Yes.
And these people stood up in the midst of huge suffering,
yes,
threat, and pain.
Yes.
And carried on. So the idea about words, what you talked about today, I just, those things came to my mind.
Those are both great examples. Could you guys hear Kathleen back here? Those are both excellent examples. I saw the King's speech, and Dogen would be proud. I mean, really, he'd be proud. I'm proud. And Churchill, you know, the thing about Churchill, which many of you don't know, is that Churchill was continually being pursued by whom? The Black Dog. Churchill had bad depression. He had bad depression. Of course, was it that bad? I don't know. There were no medications then. Churchill drank every day. That was his medication. I mean, there was no other meds. He drank every day. But in the midst of this profound crisis and this hopelessness of the British people, a lot of people were hopeless, it was Churchill who was able to come forward in the middle of with a black dog there and say these words, which really turned the consciousness of many people in Great Britain around, and just really kept their hopes up. Do you know about this? can you tell us about this?
Not really any more than you are, David.
Okay. Yeah. So I think I think these are both wonderful examples of what Dogen's talking about. Of course, I do have to also say that these are great one-shot examples, and through Zazen we're trying to learn how to make this authenticity something that just happens, and with the King it seemed like he was getting there. With Churchill, I'm not sure. So that's my... because sometimes in a situation of crisis, in a situation of emergency, anybody is able to shed their self-consciousness and do something great. But we're talking about learning to do this day to day, just by being, just by the simple act of being. And while I love those examples, it's just as much about... what we say when we're doing the dishes and our partner is doing them differently than us and not drying them the way we like to dry them, and how we wholeheartedly, it doesn't mean we agree. I mean, people think in religion, Zen becomes a lot like Roman Catholicism. When I see people at Zen centers, our Zen center is getting better, but it's like, you know, do it this way, everybody go along. But disagreeing is cool. Disagreeing is cool, because when you just try to agree, you're not really manifesting your own nature. But how can you disagree and then just let go of it? How can you just fully disagree and let go of it? That's what we're all working on. But let's not work too hard on it. Let's just do our zazen and be in our moments and see what happens. Anybody else? Okay.
I feel a little weird sitting down with him. I just don't know the idea. I just never got into the whole enlightenment thing.
Pardon?
If you're just doing that.
Well, you're right. You're right. Could you guys hear her? Yeah. I've been talking a lot about this the last few weeks. I don't know how to talk about this in a very concise way, huh?
Kim, she just said it doesn't really exist, does it?
I've been talking about two types of enlightenment, which may or may not exist. The one is enlightenment, state-based enlightenment, where there's really something really happens to your consciousness. And you can read it. You can pull up, open any book, not just on Zen, but on the teachings of the mystics, and you can read basically the same thing. A radical change in consciousness. A radical opening in which the talkative self just goes away completely. And there's only immersion in some wondrous world, which is this world. And there's no comment. That's state-based enlightenment. And a lot of Buddhism focuses on that. And then there's the enlightenment that I've been talking about lately that's more Dogen has been emphasizing, and Shahaku really emphasizes, and that is enlightening delusion. That real enlightenment is illuminating each of our delusions, each of our difficulties with our still, open, accepting mind. And that's what you're talking about. But I don't think we should deny consciousness-based enlightenment because it's there too. If it's the goal, it's not there. That's right, but that's true. If it's the goal, it's not there. If you split yourself by thinking about the goal instead of just practicing, it's not there. On the other hand, the knowledge that other people did this, other people experienced this, by not pining away for it, but by just really doing this practice, can be very inspirational to people. It was very inspirational for me when Suzuki Roshi, although he never wanted to talk about it, someone finally asked him about his enlightenment experience, and he told it. That inspired me. Now, maybe it's my greedy mind, but it inspired me to practice with more wholehearted effort. And, you know, even if it's your greedy mind, if it inspires you just to be more present, your greed is going to drop away at some point entirely. But that's a good question. That's a good question. Anybody else?
Yeah. There's something that I've been thinking a lot about lately, and it kind of goes with this. And I was actually thinking about it, what you were talking about anyway, which is idealism. And I think that that's the problem with this state-based enlightenment.
Mm.
Caught up in making pictures about this experience, and that, of course, is nothing like experiencing anything. And then you probably aren't even experiencing pictures, because you're kind of caught up and taken away by them, right?
Yeah.
So, and I think that that's the same thing with what. I have the same question with what Dogen talked about with worry. And so I guess the question is, what is the pivot between getting caught in idealism and just forecasting or projecting these experiences and creating big concepts about worry, as opposed to what Dogen talked about with experiencing everything as it is. Words can't be
left
out of that.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting. I think you need to go into that. That's an interesting question. That's an important con for you, for us to go into. Because if there were an answer, what would that be? That's dead. The answer is to go in and see that the question and the answer aren't two. To really go inside and see that. And they are two, but they aren't two. Anything else? Thank you.